Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover in Lodo. Thank you so much for coming tonight. Thank you for supporting our author events. And thank you for supporting us, because this month it's our 40th birthday. So it's a wonderful pleasure for me to introduce New York Times bestselling author Alexandra Fuller, who will talk about her new book, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness, which is now number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list. And this is the second memoir about Alexandra's family's life in Africa. And in it, we learn more about Alexandra's mother, who refers to herself as Nicola Fuller of Central Africa. We first met Alexandra's parents in the memoir Don't Let's Go the Dogs Tonight, when they lived in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, during the war. And it was Alexandra's memories of her childhood. In Cocktail Hour, Alexandra's now grown with children of her own and lives in this country. And she tells the story of her mother, who was born on the Isle of Skye in Scotland, and who, like many, fights bouts of depression, but that doesn't stop her from living an amazingly full life of humor and love and excitement and a bit of folly. It's just another Alexandra Fuller book you will not want to put down, and I certainly didn't. I found myself reading and admiring her parents so much for their courage and their stick-to-itiveness when most would give up entirely. Nicola Fuller describes her daughter's first book as that awful book. But I describe both Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight and Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness as love stories to her parents and Africa with all its beauty and harshness. I can't imagine what strength and understanding it must have taken her to write this, but I thank her for sharing all of her stories with us. Please welcome Alexandra Fuller.
Thank you for coming out to your local independent bookstore, and thank you, Tattered. I know it sounds like a commercial. Thank you for having me back. I think I've been here 3 times. You're starting to feel like family. And it is just so rare anymore. In the short time that I've been publishing, which has been a decade, there were these bookstores across the country, and now they simply don't exist anymore. And I think that what we have lost is a place for the life of the mind, and a place where we can come and know that we are kind of taken care of and you can leave yourself behind. So thank you, Tattered Cover, and another 40 years at least. And here's to you, there's none like you, and if they were, they're all dead, as my mother would say. So in the year 2000, there were elections in this country, some of you may remember, and the side that I was rooting for lost. So I thought I would become an American citizen and change that balance, naively, because I live in Wyoming. And as they say in Wyoming, the cowboys there are like, well, you're a liberal, are you? And I say yes, and they say, well, you're probably a vegetarian too, so that's all right. One bad winter and poof, you'll be gone. So but I decided to become an American citizen, which it turns out is, mostly because I actually have such a big mouth, really, to be honest with you, and I will voice my political opinions, and that has to do with growing up in Rhodesia and Zambia and Zimbabwe, countries that are not fans of freedom of speech, and I like to speak my mind, and you can't. So I was super excited to get to the States where there's freedom of speech. And, you know, because you have 2 things. You have Michael Jackson and freedom of speech. And I was so jealous, and I was thrilled to be here. And and my husband's American, and I would, like, go out to, really, and my husband would be like, you know, just because I thought everyone would be having freedom of speech all the time, nonstop, 24/7. And you maybe you'd need like a football helmet and those shoulder pad thingies, but you would be exercising it. And my husband said to me finally, he's like, you know what? Just because you've now got freedom of speech does not mean you need to exercise it 24/7. He's like, you know what? You're like the nouveau riche of freedom of speech. He goes, those of us who've had it for a few generations. Anyway, so I became an American citizen, and it was a very moving experience, and being me, very like my mother, if I'm going to do something, I shall get passionately involved in it. And so, you know, I was, what can I bring to this country? And weep. I mean, you should have seen me in camera at the swearing-in ceremony. They just about had to cut me out in a gurney. I was so moved by the whole thing. Because, you know, like, you get married, and it's like, easy come, easy go, but you're giving up. I mean, I had to renounce the prince. The guy who sang Purple Rain, I was like, that is a big deal. And then I have three children. My oldest is 18. My son is 15. And I have a baby who's 6. And when our children reach a certain age, sort of double digits, somewhere in the tweenies, when they start to figure out that they, you know, are separate, you hope, from you, we allow, budget allowing, the kids to choose anywhere reasonable in the world to go, that they feel that they belong. So where their soul yearns to be. So my oldest daughter is a very sort of serious type of person. And she chose to go to Anne Frank's annex in Holland. So we trooped off then. It was a very somber thing. My son, when he was 11, wanted to go and see the Statue of Liberty, which I think has to do with growing up being a boy in Wyoming and just being desperate to see anything in a skirt. So we go out to see the Statue of Liberty. And on the way back, we went to Ellis Island, which I, of course, now I'm like a recent American citizen. I'm sobbing. If you haven't been to Ellis Island, I highly recommend. I mean, the Statue of Liberty, blah. But Ellis Island, I wept. I was there. I felt every Irish experience. I was, you know, I was a mess. My husband and my son were so embarrassed. They went to get an ice cream. But on the boat going back, they've got those little pamphlets that have like, you know, all the names of the people went through Ellis Island, and my married name is Ross, and there were a zillion Rosses, and that was it, man. I lost it. I was like, oh my gosh, do you think that your family could have come over through Ellis Island? And my husband looks at me. He's, you know, a WASP from Sewickley, Pennsylvania. He goes, I don't think my people were boat people. And my son goes, yeah, Mom, we were yacht people. So there went that dream. Anyway, shortly after becoming an American citizen, and maybe in a way because to figure out who I was, who am I, and also because I had failed, I'd written 10 novels by then, which were all themes along the line of there's this lovely sort of adorable younger daughter, and she lives in Africa with her bossy older sister and her taciturn father and her drunk, eccentric mother. And then 3/4 of the way through the book, she tragically dies. And everyone else in her family feels wretched about it and spends the rest of the book weeping at her grave and wishing they'd be nicer to her. So I wrote 10 books along that line. And my agent said, you know, I don't know. Like, I don't think Americans want to read about Africans necessarily. Maybe you could put some Americans and then some sex. And I was like, God, well, I'm British. We can't even talk about that. So I had lesbians because I figured at least then I didn't have to say, you know, words that began with P or anything. And and so now it was bad. Like, I have American aid workers having bad lesbian sex in Africa. I mean, the whole, it just was, really, there was, and my agent fired me. And I was suicidal. And so my husband left to climb active volcanoes in Mexico rather than being with me and a whole bunch of sharp knives. And when he left to go and climb active volcanoes, he left an envelope on his computer that said, only to be opened in the event of my death. So, of course, I waited till he got to the end of his driveway and I ripped it open. It was the most boring letter I've ever read in my life. I mean, considering it ostensibly came from the other side. I mean, blah, 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 mortgage, yabba, 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 health insurance. But, you know, not, what? This is it? This is, you're dead? This is the message? This is all you've got left to give me? But at the end, he said, you know, I think you should just tell the truth. So while he was off not getting blown up by volcanoes, I wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. And mostly because I thought at that point, you know, my agent had fired me and I was so rejected by every major publishing house and minor and like self-publishing house and everything in the whole country that I thought I would never get the thing published, and now I'm published, and so now I've got a phone home. And we have very limited cell phone reception, fortunately, on the farm. And phone calls back home go something like this. Dad picks up the phone. He goes, "Oh my God, it's one of the bloody children. Nicola, put your drink down. It's one of the kids. I can't hear them. Deaf. Hang on. Wait for your mother." And then you can hear all the dogs getting kicked, and you can hear my mother sort of swaying up from the tree of forgetfulness. And there's the reception is sort of on this anthill, and my mother goes, you know, more or less in or out, depending. It's a very narrow range of cell phone reception, so depending on how much she's swaying, the reception is more or less good. And then, so I said, "Mom, good news is I've been published." She said, "Well, what can the bad news possibly be? Tim, do you hear that? The child's been published." I said, "Well, the bad news is..." And I hung up. My mother, not thrilled about Don't Let's Go to Dogs Tonight. She did not see it as my memoir. She saw it as a biography of her, and she did not think it was a flattering biography whatsoever. And I'm keeping an eye on time. I'm a bit worried that someone waved, someone shoot me, dart me. So she didn't see it the way I did, which was that it was my story. Instead, she saw it was her story, and it was not, you know, her view of herself at all. So I tried to appeal to the literary snob in her, which is not immodest. And I said, "But Mom, it's getting, you know, really that book did not get a single bad review. Unlike Scribbling the Cat, my kids love reading the reviews of Scribbling the Cat on Amazon. They're like, 'Oh, Mom, come, you got to see this. This person would have given you less than one star, except you can't do that on Amazon. Oh, that's hilarious. They hate you so much.'" So I said to my mom, "Oh, my kids do all sorts of things. They want to videotape me doing whatever, what you call it, digital, record me doing Pilates and put it on YouTube. My son wants to write a book called Mothers That Detox, The Wilson Years by Fuller Ross." Mom wasn't thrilled, but the reviews were really good. So I said to Mommy, "It didn't get a bad review." And she goes, "Yes, I think that's disgusting too. Other people laughing at my misfortune. Very German of them, I think." And I love that about my mother, because it is like a parlor game with her. Like, you can give her an ethnicity, she'll throw back a stereotype. Ethnicity stereotype, right? So my favorite example of that was that not that long ago, having lost everything, they'd lost farms and wars and children, and my mother had lost her mind, and they were reduced to really nothing. They didn't even have a house of their own. Someone had lent them a two-bedroom cottage that was literally two bedrooms that they could live in, and there was a little, as my mother calls it, picking and kaya out back. That was it. It was the bare basics, and they didn't even necessarily have enough fuel to get into town. They had to really consider whether or not a trip to town was worth the petrol. In fact, my husband just had a really bad riding accident this summer. A horse squashed him. And it turns out I am African-American. I read a I know this seems like it's going nowhere. It's going somewhere. Just stay with me. I read in this Harper's Findings, you know, where it says aphid, turns out that aphids, blah, blah, blah. It said, African-Americans in a crisis call their friends. They don't call 911. So I have a 1,200-pound, 1,500-pound horse, huge horse, 16-two-hand horse, lying on my husband. And I do have a cell phone. I called all my friends. I'm like, "Oh, God, you should see this." It didn't even occur to me to call 911. It was one of the friends who had to call 911. Anyway, ambulance arrived at the same time as my friends. And things are serious. So then they were going to helicopter flight him to Idaho Falls. And they said, "Well, you can't come because we've got weight problems." I said, "I can lose weight in a hurry. How much of these clothes do you need me to take off?" And it was a Mormon flight crew. And they're like, "Oh, my God, okay, just put her on the plane before she strips." And then things went, you know, really catastrophically downhill once we got to Idaho Falls. So I managed to get an airplane at midnight, put my husband on this airplane at midnight, get him to another hospital in Salt Lake City. And then he looked like he was gone. And I have some experience in that line. And they finally flew him in a helicopter the size of a mosquito from one hospital to the other, and he lived. I mean, it was amazing. So I phone home, and I tell them about my last 5 days in which I haven't slept, eaten, or whatever else. And there's this long silence from my father. I thought I'd dropped the connection. And then finally, he goes, "Bloody hell, it's an awful lot of aviation gas, isn't it?" What you've got to love about my parents is that if you go and stay with them on the farm and you get bitten by a snake, they will be calculating the odds of you surviving the trip to town before they bother taking you there, because why waste the petrol? Anyway, so this is all to say they've now lost everything. And at a late age, when most people are thinking about retirement, my parents found a 100-acre farm in the middle Zambezi Valley. And in a very African way, they went to the chief, as you're supposed to, and did all the things that you're supposed to do to the chief and the headman. And the headman agreed to give them the lease of this land for 99 years. But my dad thought that was terrific. He goes, bloody hell, I'm 60 years old. He must think I look fabulous, 99-year lease. But they literally had nothing. They didn't even have a tractor to clear this farm. So the Ministry of Agriculture in Zambia were doing experiments with donkeys, and they gave my parents 2 donkeys. My parents had decided at that point to become full-on Zambians, and so they qualified. I mean, this isn't something you should boast about. They were so poor, they qualified for 2 free donkeys in Zambia. That's how bad things got. But my mother, ever the optimist, called these donkeys Flash and Lightning. And they did this amazing job. They cleared this farm. And then Flash died of tsetse fly, of sleeping sickness. And that made Lightning very sad. And my mother said, Lightning brayed and brayed and brayed. And she said, God, it was awful. But it wasn't as bad as when we had to have that Filipino stay with us. And I'm thinking, where is this going? And it turned out that my mother is now a fish farmer. And she's such a successful fish farmer that the Filipinos were so impressed. And they, you know, very good fish farmers themselves. They thought they would like to take a Zambian from my parents' farms to the Philippines to show them their farming, and then they would take some poor, hapless, clueless Filipino from the Philippines to my parents' farm. And I was like, oh my God, I mean, at least give her a copy of Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight as a primer. Anyway, this poor woman, and my mother says, well, Annie the Filipino, the flipping Filipino, those Filipinos are just like donkeys. You can't have one of them. She howled and howled and howled. She had terrible cultural hock and was very lonely. So only my mother would put a Filipino and donkey in the same sentence. She is so politically incorrect. She makes Sean Hannity look like a, you know, Zen Buddhist monk. And so it would just feel like a crime against humanity not to just keep writing about her, really. Anyway, she was very, very furious about Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. And one of her, she was so furious, she organized actually a boycott against me, which, you know, she learned about boycotts and sanctions and stuff from the Rhodesians, so she was really good at it. And so no one south of the equator or north of the Limpopo would talk to me. I was just getting iced left and right. My mother was thrilled. They're all on her side. She's very George W. Bush that way. You're either for her or, as far as you're concerned, you need to get blown off the planet with a big mortar. So her objection when she did finally talk to me was, you don't know me, you have no idea who I am, and you don't know what my intentions are or my motives. And I thought, you know, to be honest, she's right. I knew my mother as the experience, as being on the receiving end of her, but I didn't really know what had motivated her or who she was. So I said, you know what, I'll interview you the way would do an interview with anybody else as a reporter. But I wanted to meet on neutral ground where there were not guns. So, Scotland. And so we met there for several days, and I taped hours and hours and hours of interviews with her. But my overwhelming sense, like, you know, runaway feeling when I left, the kind of tidal wash of my memory of those interviews was how hostile my mother had been. It was mostly a eugenics lesson. My mother going on about, I have 2 zillion% pure Highland Scottish blood in my veins, not you. Your father's probably got Armenian in him somewhere. If you weren't switched at birth, probably you were switched at birth. And the only thing, by the way, that had consoled my mother when Don't Let's Go the Dogs came out, was that I had become an American citizen. So that was good, because then she could say, this is my American daughter, you know, disdainfully. Yeah, this is the other one. And although, don't get me wrong, my mother is a huge fan of the United States of America and everything for which it stands, and particularly because she came over to this country with my sister, my older sister. My mother has always been determined that somebody was going to write a book about her, and who better to train for that job than one of your children? So when she was pregnant with my elder sister, she read that fetal child, the complete works of Shakespeare, including the sonnets, right? By the time Vanessa came out, she was done with literature. She refuses to read or write at all. I mean, she is functionally illiterate. Her vocabulary is this is my sister's vocabulary. The last time I was home, my dad's decided now that he's 70, he's going to die. I've done my 3 score year and 10. And so that's it. I was like, Dad, just because it's in the Bible doesn't mean you have to do it. Nope, that's it. I'm not going to bat another chap's innings. That's bad form. So he's picked his baobab tree he's going to be planted under, and that's it. So Vanessa goes, all right. We're all sitting there. Vanessa goes, right, we've got to talk about what happens when Dad snuffs it. She goes, I can't do it. Bobo, you're going to have to do the urology. That's my sister, right? So when my mom and my sister fly over here, they give you a little form. If you're not an American, you'll know this. They give you a little form on the airplane if you're foreign, and it says things like, have you ever been a Nazi? Or are you ever been a member of the Communist Party? Do you intend harm against the President of the United States? Are you carrying drugs? Do you have more than $1 million on you? Do you intend to blow up the White House? Are you a terrorist? Vanessa just goes, yes, 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 yes. My mom says, it was so exciting. We got to Atlanta, and this cop waddled across. Soon as he saw, waddled over, grabbed Vanessa, frog marched her off, and he was waddling. He had to waddle because he had a gun strapped to every limb and one dangling from every orifice. It was very impressive. And I could see Vanessa through the little slit of the window in this tiny little room, and it was just your sister and a whole bunch of weeping Mexicans. It was fantastic. And then then she came over with my dad, and I live in Wyoming, and in the summer I live near the Green River, and my father loves to fish, so I thought I would give him a day on the river with a cowboy. And you know what cowboys are like, and you know, my father is a banana farmer, so my dad is dressed. I said to Dad, you know, you might want to dress for the mosquitoes. They're famous on the Green River, right? And my dad goes, mosquitoes, we've got mosquitoes in Africa, malaria, blah, blah, and all Wyoming mosquitoes. Rah. So he goes fish. I warned him. He went dressed as a Zambian banana farmer. So he had these big flappy Bermuda shorts and a little bush hat. My mother said, it was awful. These mosquitoes swooped in like jackals, and they siphoned every last drop out of your father's body. He was just a piece of skin flapping against bone. The United States of America is terrifically dangerous. It's wonderful. Anyway, the interviews were so hostile, these taped interviews, that I just put them in my office and I left them there until 2 years ago. I got whooping cough and I was sick for 100 days. And unless you have some pre-existing condition that forbids it, I highly recommend whooping cough because you sound so awful for 100 days that no one will come to visit you, and you will get all that reading done that you need to get. So I got lots and lots of reading done, and that was terrific. And then I ran out of reading, believe it or not, and I thought, gosh, I wonder if I've got those tapes. Maybe I should listen to them. And it turns out that a degree of a fever with a degree of 101 is the perfect remove with which to hear my mother. Because lying there listening in a sort of slightly fragile state, what I could hear her say under the words is, you know, I am someone. I was someone. I had hopes and dreams and passions. And I was the most glamorous woman that ever lived in East Africa, and I had these children and I loved them. And for the first time, she spoke to me about what it was like to lose her oldest child, Adrian. She was 24 years old when he died of meningitis, and my parents had been homeless before he died in what was then Rhodesia, and it had been a terrible winter. And my mother's unbelievably vivid recall in her language, the winter had been so bad that the papaya trees had turned black and plopped over. And my mother talks about how after my brother died, walking out of the hospitals into Meikle Square, which is in the center of what is now Harare, and the jacarandas were in bloom, and the flower sellers were selling agapanthus, and the storm clouds were boiling on the horizon. And my mother said, there was all this life. And I thought, how can there be all this life? Because the world has just ended. And I could hear my mother for the first time. And it was, I realized that I had written Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, I think with a fair amount of judgment, and maybe even anger, even though at the time that I wrote it, I would have argued that it was the most compassionate book I could have written. But listening to my mother, I came to a place of true compassion. My mother was 24 when she lost my brother, at the time that I was listening to the tapes, I'm almost old enough to be her mother. And I wanted to do that most impossible thing, which was reach back in time and stop what was going to happen next, which was that she would go on to lose two more children, several farms, and eventually her mind. And I couldn't do that. And the fact that she had made a decision to survive was so, I was so absolutely knee-bucklingly in awe and admiration of her. And so this book came out of that deep, deep awe and admiration, which does not, by the way, take away the fact that she was not a pampering mother. That is not true. I'm going to read a little bit. Where my mother was growing up in Kenya, they would go back to, because they were British. You know, my parents sort of lived in that time in the 40s and 50s, which when you grew up being British, I had a basic idea in geography and history lessons was that the entire globe belonged to you. And if you weren't British, then whatever culture you were was just a failed attempt at being British, and it was going to be all right once they got there and sorted you out. And then that proved not to be the case. And over the course of my mother's and father's lifetime, and the great gift that they have shown me is that at the end, when they had nothing left, nothing, they did not have a roof that they owned over their heads, they didn't, you know, really have petrol to make it into town, my father looked at my mother, who had lost her mind at that point, and he said, "Africa is for Africans, and you and I are Africans." And they made a decision to become truly African, and they will die there and be buried there, and that is where they put their blood and their sweat and their love, for good and sometimes for absolutely bad. But when they were growing up, they were all very British, as my mother says. "We Parker, Parker sahibs," we were, because... And when they would... I mean, really. And when they would go back to England on leave, you know, on the ship, apparently when you cross the equator, if it was your first time crossing the equator in a ship, someone hauled a dead fish out of a bucket and slapped you with it. I mean, how British is that? Like, I mean, the only thing more British is that is that something that happens with a hamster in boarding school. And then my mother goes, and the next worst thing were these awful fancy dress parties. We were stuck into these dreadful costumes and had to parade around the ship, and oh, I hated it. So here we are, Mum now in her early 30s, having apparently learned nothing from her experience as a child, dressing Vanessa and me up for the Davis's annual fancy dress party, an event I might have not dreaded at all if Mum hadn't chosen costumes of such agonizing inventiveness that it's a wonder they didn't kill us. "Why can't I be like Vanessa?" I asked. "Because," Mum said. "But I'm itchy," I complained. Olivia, that's my baby sister, was only 4 months old, too small to be anything murderous. So Mum had dressed her in a homemade rainbow-colored tie-dyed onesie as the Summer of Love. Vanessa was a rose, hypoallergenic and splendid in a pink tutu, pink tights, and pink ballet slippers. I was, "I never promised you a rose garden," in an old vest and a pair of knickers inside an empty insecticide drum, on which my mother had pasted a few pictures of weeds cut out from the pages of Farmers Weekly. "No one's going to understand what I am," I pointed out. "The clever ones will," said Mum. "Now hold still, I don't want to poke your eyes out." There was a sound of Mum attacking the insecticide drum with scissors. "I think I'm getting a rash," I said. "I can feel bumps." Mum started to sing, "I beg your pardon, I never promised you a rose garden." There was a pause, followed by a couple more violent assaults against the insecticide drum. Then Mum said to Vanessa, "Go to the kitchen and fetch me a knife, would you, Vanessa? And ask July for a nice sharp one." "I can't breathe," I said. "Oh, buck up, Bobo. Wouldn't it be easier if I got out?" "No, it wouldn't." "But then you won't poke my eyes out." "Whoever said anything about poking eyes out?" "You did. Don't exaggerate." I could hear Vanessa rustle demurely back into the room. "Thank you, darling," Mum said. She only called one of us darling when she wanted to imply that the other was not at that moment darling. "You're such a big help," Mum said. I didn't need to be on the outside of my insecticide drum to see the pink ruffles on Vanessa's tutu puffing up. "Now hold still, Bobo." There were flashes from a knife blade and two slits of lights appeared. "Are those near your eyes?" No, I said. And then I reconsidered my close escape. Yes, I said. Yes, very. There we go then, Mum said. I'll just get my Uzi and we'll be off. I took a deep breath. I don't want to go, I blurted out with as much feeling as I could muster out of my nearly 8-year-old self. I look stupid. Now look here, Mum said. If you aren't careful, you'll get a jolly good hiding. Well, Mum got her gun. I weighed up the cons of a jolly good hiding versus the cons of arriving at a fancy dress party dressed in an insecticide drum. I decided on balance that at least there'd be Sperletta cream soda and Willard's chips at the fancy dress party. And that at least the Davises didn't have frogs in their pool, or only a few, not like our algae soup of a pool that had wild ducks, scorpions, thousands of frogs, tadpoles, and the occasional Nile monitor lizard. Plus, this would be my last party before I was packed off to boarding school forever and ever. Right, Mum said. I heard her check her Uzi magazine for rounds. Bullets, lipstick, sunglasses. Off we go. Come on, baby. Quick march. My feet poked out of two holes in the drum's lid. I couldn't walk very well. I had to waddle like a penguin. This amused Vanessa. And her peals of laughter echoed around inside the insecticide drum. Mum, with a lever on her hip, helped me out of the big door, down the rough stone steps and onto the veranda. Don't fall, Vanessa said, barely able to contain the hope in her voice. It was very hot inside the drum, and sweat poured into my already stinging eyes and into my increasingly stinging rash. I'm boiling, I whined. One more word of you, Mum warned. We scuffled across the yard into the driveway and arrived at Lucy, the mineproof Land Rover, where a problem presented itself. I didn't fit through any of the doors. Dear, Mum said, an unforeseen hitch. There was a silence while she had a think. Then she spoke again. We'll put her in the back, she paused. Darling, she said, not to me. Go and fetch July and Violet. So Vanessa called July from the kitchen and she fetched Violet from the laundry. Then there was general hilarity while July and Violet each considered how amazing it was that the madam had put her young daughter into an insecticide drum. Mum explained that when she was in labor with me in England, the radio was playing I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, which was prophetic, because when I arrived, I really was, as promised, not a rose garden. Mum has refused to waver from the story, even though I have since discovered the song became a hit for Lynn Anderson a full year and a half after I was born, and therefore could not have been playing when she was in labor with me. She had yellow skin and black hair. That's why we called her Bobo, Mum explained, because she looked just like a little baboon. When I was writing this book, I found it helpful, considering my mother wasn't the kind of person. She's more of a sort of, I mean, as a mother, my mother followed the first rule of writing, which was show, don't tell. She just showed me how to live, I realize now. I mean, she is the most unedited, passionate woman I have ever met. And she is so unafraid of herself. And I think the older we get, certainly the older, I'll speak for myself, the older I get, and the more you get knocked around and the more afraid you are and the more likely you are to start self-censoring and maybe just thinking, you know, I'm just not going to bother. I don't feel like getting beaten up over it. Not my mother. Full charge ahead forever and ever. And she expects us to sing the Alleluia chorus and leap into the grave after her when she dies. And so when I was writing this book, I thought, wouldn't it be brilliant if I could think of a sort of a coherent theme that I could keep going back to as I'm writing. And when I was writing Colton H. Bryant, which was the story of a roughneck that was killed in the rigs of Wyoming, I had done this thing. I'd gotten so frustrated and I was so in terror of writing about something that I had no business writing about because I'm not from Wyoming, I'm not a cowboy, and I'm not a roughneck, that I'd once typed everything into a Google search engine. That I knew Colton loved, so I'd put his pickup truck in there. So I put pickup truck, hunt and shoot and fish and snowmobile, Mountain Dew, Copenhagen Chew, and I pressed enter, and it said, "You might be a redneck, Ev." And his mother loved that. I printed it out for his mother. And so along the same principle, I printed out my mother's 10 commandments, which I'd like to share with you. Number one, when in doubt, wear an ascot hat. Don't worry, the bat droppings on its brim will just give it character. Number two, live your life as if it were going to be a biography or an opera. Accordingly, create a soundtrack for yourself. My mother's features Frank Sinatra and Doris Day. Number three, acquire a few needs. A pack of dogs, a few good books, and a bottle of something halfway decent to drink are all that is really essential. And if you can't get something halfway decent, something absolutely crappy and lousy and warm will do. Number four, learn a second or third language, regardless of what this language is, Swahili, German, or Nyanja, for example. Speak it loudly and with an Italian accent. Number five, redefine failure. So what if you lose your farms, a war, or your mind? If it was dramatic and will make good dinner conversation, then it was a success. Number six, understand wealth in terms of the well-being of animals, the land, and the water around you. Number seven, choose curiosity over certainty. Number eight, pledge allegiance to the earth and be prepared to die for it. Number nine, if it makes sense to your dogs and it's sensible. Number 10, the test of a strong mind is whether or not it can be changed without breaking. When I was interviewing both my parents, once I decided I was going to write this book, much to my amazement, my parents, I think hoping to influence the outcome of it, became very collaborative witnesses to their own story. And my dad's very taciturn. It's hard to get him to talk much about anything. But I flew them out to South Africa to spend a couple of weeks with me, and we went to this very secluded place, and it was great because we could just spend the afternoons talking. I just put a tape recorder down, and it really wasn't interviews. And there was a moment when Mum had gone back inside the cottage to get something, and my dad sort of leaned forward as if it was the only thing important that I walk away from any of this from. And he said, you know, it's not that your mother didn't want to protect you. It's just there was so much to protect you from. And that chiropractically shifted everything that then went into the book. That, along with the fact that I understood by then what incredible courage it had taken for her to regain her mind. And that she has been a great gift to me and an inspiration. I mean, if I write, I write because my mother taught me at a very early age. I mean, I would tag around. I mean, she didn't care. She went, and if you didn't follow her, oh well, easy come, easy go. So she would race around the farm on a horse or, you know, something else, and you, Johnny, well, you know, if you were hoping to get back alive, you didn't want to lose her, be glued to her. But I witnessed her, and maybe that's something that just comes with being born wanting, you know, to be a writer, but I don't think so. Witnessing my mother, and then she would come home at night, and I would hear her tell my father the stories of her day, and this incredible, vivid, wonderful language. And it was that. It was watching my mother transform her daily experiences into this fantastic evening of entertainment every night that taught me what stories were. And because in Africa, well, in parts of Africa I've lived anyway, and with the kinds of people I've lived with in Africa, there's always a fair amount of alcohol. If you're now telling these stories around a campfire, there's the added challenge of being entertaining enough that someone who's absolutely hammered isn't going to doze off and fall into a campfire. When I first left Africa to come to the West, I was terrified. I think if you have been born anywhere that is not a Western power, you labor under the illusion that everybody else in the world knows what they're doing and you won't have a clue, and that all power is seated here and that you're powerless and invisible. And I expressed something along the lines of that to my mother, my doubt and panic about, you know, being in the powerful Western world. And my mother grips me in the Lusaka airport, her hands on my shoulders, and she says, "Don't worry, baby. Anything they try to do to you over there, we've already done to you here." And she's right, you know. I mean, Americans can do scary stuff, but nothing that scared me off yet. And this spring, I happened to be in New York, and there was an installation, performance art. It was a video, an installation. It wasn't performance art. It was an installation of a female lawyer being interviewed. She's an elderly woman who had been the lawyer for one of the men who had blown up the World Trade Center, and so an incredibly unpopular figure right off the bat. And this video was so unbelievably moving. I started to sob so uncontrollably that security began to sort of shuffle in, you know. And I couldn't leave the installation, because what she was speaking about so powerfully, this woman, wasn't about her client or being a lawyer. She was talking about how poetry had, had made her who she was, how poetry inspired her. And she read various poems, but there was one poem that I want to leave you with that reminded me so much of my mother that I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed, and then went and sat through the whole video thing again until she said it again, and then I sobbed more, and yeah, nearly, I almost got arrested. It's a Bertolt Brecht poem. It's called "And I Always Thought." And it is absolutely written for my mother, although Bertolt Brecht probably didn't know that. "And I always thought the very simplest words must be enough. When I say what things are like, everyone's heart must be torn to shreds. That you'll go down if you don't stand up for yourself. Surely you see that." Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.